Hello and welcome to Philosophy with Will Anderson. I'm Will Anderson. From the title of the podcast, here is another live episode that was recorded at the Sydney Opera House as part of the Just for Laughs Festival in December. These have been sitting up on my Patreon page for Philosophy. That is a way you can support the podcast, but I'm not going to ask you to support the podcast when the fucking podcast has not really been happening. Is it back? Not yet. I am hoping it will be back at some stage, but in the meantime, just a couple of the live episodes that I'm putting in the feed. They are not full episodes, they're just an hour that we had to do the live show, so I would love to have both last week's guest, Nish Kumar, and today's guest, Veer Das, a brilliant comedian and a brilliant thinker about comedy. I think he has now 5 Netflix specials that you can go and watch, including the story that he references in this very chat that we had at the Sydney Opera House. Thank you to everybody who came to the live show and supported that. And I hope that these couple of episodes are just something fun to be in the feed for people who have been missing the show. But in the meantime, I have some things to plug. Yep, that's the deal. That's why I'm putting them up. I have some things to plug. So I hope you enjoy these episodes. But also, I have a book. It is called I Am Not Fine, Thanks. It is available in all the places that you find books. It would be good if you bought a copy of that. I have a special that is on ABC iView. It's free. It's called Willogical. You can just go on to ABC iView and watch Willogical for free. And I have a new touring show. It is called Illuminate. All new material, and it is out on the road. Next stop is Canberra. Canberra this Saturday night as part of the Canberra Comedy Festival. There are still some tickets available. Not a heap, but getting quick if you want to come and see me on Saturday night in Canberra for the Canberra Comedy Festival. Then after that, Thursday night, I'll be in Darwin at the Darwin Entertainment Centre. Darwin friends, it has been a long time since I have been in Darwin doing a show. It's been way too long, considering that I normally go to Darwin every year or every second year to do shows. So please come and see Illuminate at the Darwin Entertainment Centre. And then after that, it's the Melbourne International Comedy Festival. I'm doing the last 2 weeks of the festival, 12 shows only. They are selling very well. So if you would like to come to those shows, I would suggest booking a ticket sooner rather than later. After that, there's the Sydney Comedy Festival, the Brisbane Comedy Festival. There is Townsville gigs that I already have booked in, and then a bunch of other shows that I hopefully will be doing as well. Really enjoying putting this new show together and getting it out on the road. Thanks to everyone who came and saw the show in Hobart the other night. I really do have to cut it down from that 90 minutes it was in Hobart. I don't get to do 90 minutes most places. Most of the festival slots are always 1 hour. So thank you to everyone in Hobart who came and had such a fun time at the Theatre Royal in Hobart. Oh, I should mention for people in the Northern Rivers of New South Wales, I am looking at adding another date of What You're Talking About, Will, my improvised stand-up show at the Brunswick Picture House. That will be happening in the next week or so, I think. So keep your eyes out for that as well. It is not added at this stage. I have to send an email after I did this introduction. I did them in the wrong order. I could have sent the email and then I would have known if I was doing that gig, and then I could have done this introduction. But anyway, that's not the way that I've done it. I hope you enjoy this chat that I had at the Sydney Opera House with Veer Das. Hello and welcome to Philosophy with Will Anderson. I am Will Anderson from the title of the podcast, and this is how the show starts. I ask my guests who they are. So, who are you?
I am here legally.
I'm not from the government. Yeah. I'm not saying
that. That's just how I start every podcast. Let's just say I have the requisite paperwork. And no, my name is Veer Das, and I'm a comedian from Mumbai in India.
It is lovely to have you here, Veer. I am super excited to have you on the show. The reason in particular is that comedians often talk about being brave, yes, but you are genuinely brave. I genuinely think you are one of the most brave comedians in the entire world. In fact, you're not even sure that if you're even going to be able to make it back to India.
Well, I will go there legally also.
legally in the short term, but it might not be for long. Now, I asked people who they are, and you started by saying you're a comedian.
Yes.
You are an actor, you're a musician, but you are a stand-up comedian.
Primarily a stand-up comedian.
And one of the most brilliant stand-up comedians in the entire world. But you also...
Let's just do this for an hour. You flatter me and we'll sit here...
Normally I'm actually not this effusive at the start.
I am a bit cooler,
but it's been a while since I've been super excited by watching another stand-up comedian in their work. Because, as I said, a lot of the time when people talk about being brave, it is a lot of the biggest comedians in the world at the moment when they're being brave, when they're being edgy, when they're being interesting. Quite often it's just punching down at minorities or people don't have power in society. Whereas you actually put it out there on the line. There is an incredible piece you did at the Kennedy Center.
Yes.
About two different Indias.
Yes.
And can you just explain to people what that piece was, what the motivation of that piece was?
I believe I come from the greatest country in the world. And I believe like any country that is a superpower or that is looking to be a superpower, there exists, you know, happiness and darkness in your country. And I feel like in a post-truth world where social media kind of convinces us that everything is darkness and everything is sad, I did a video about the duality of my nation and to remind people to remember and unite in the light. And it caused a lot of duality in my nation. And many people united in being pissed off at me. And... Yeah. And the aftermath of that, as we know, is I had some criminal complaints filed against me. And I was on... Every news, like three different news channels call me a terrorist on the primetime news, which is an interesting conversation with your mother that evening. you know, just being like, hey, you said you didn't know how to describe what I do for a living. They seem to have found a word. but I wouldn't term that as bravery. It's more recklessness than anything else, you know?
It isn't, though, because I know that that's a self-deprecating way of you getting into this. But the piece that you did in particular, if you need an introduction to Veer, he has like four Netflix specials, I think, at the moment.
Yes.
Another one that you've just recorded that is about, you know...
About the aftermath, yeah.
The aftermath of this. But this Kennedy Center piece, it's actually quite a short piece that people can watch.
Mm-hmm.
And... the way that it is written is very much done with that idea of you talking about the idea of here is something positive about India,
yeah.
And I guess here is something that maybe isn't quite as positive about India. And
yeah.
It's a beautifully written piece. It's a beautifully expressed piece.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't write something that it is that well thought out without also thinking of what the aftermath of that piece might be.
Well, okay. That is a very complimentary way of thinking about my mental process. But... But the truth of the matter is, my wife and I, we were touring D.C. And I was just in a good mood. And I was like, oh, look at all these monuments. And I was missing home because it was week 5 of being on tour, which is peak homesickness, like right the last week. And at 3 p.m., no, at 1 p.m. before a 9 p.m. show, I kind of wrote it down on a piece of paper because it was in my head. And I went to my wife and I was like, should I do this? And she's like, yeah, what could go wrong? and so we didn't have a camera. So we got on Yelp and called a wedding photographer who happened to be unemployed on that Sunday. And he brought like his wedding camera and put it up at the Kennedy Center. And that's why I have a paper in my hand, because I don't remember it. It's new material. So the lesson is really don't treat the Kennedy Center as your open mic, I think is the... But no, I didn't think it through at all. I just... It was a moment of experimentation. I did it after the show, so I'd done 2 hours of stand-up. They were happy. I never saw any of it coming. So, no, I didn't have any foresight going into it, to be honest.
So what was the motivation of the piece then? You like you said, you're in this place where obviously it was triggering a lot of things in your mind about the nature of, you know, you're at the Kennedy Center,
yeah.
You know, you even say that in the introduction to the piece, you know, you talk about great people and what great people have said, the courage to say things that sometimes people don't want you to say.
Yeah.
So what was the motivation of actually writing the piece? Because as much as you say you did it that day, you still, there's got to be a motivation behind it. There's got to be a reason that you sit down and you think, these are important things for me to say.
Okay, I want to clarify a few things. It wasn't money, because I had the money already. I don't know, you know, I travel across the world. I've been very blessed. You know, I was able to go to 28 countries this year. God's been very kind. And Indian people, having a billion of us really helps, you know, wherever you are in the world. So we come out for these shows and we expect a taste of home. You know, when you're an Indian singer, when you're an Indian artist, people are coming to your show to say, take me home. Some of them haven't been home in 10 years or 15 years. Some of them have been raised with this strange notion of home that their parents left behind in 1975. And they haven't experienced amazing modern India. And so it was partly that, you know, and it was partly, I feel like we get a bad rap because of social media and because of all these other things. And so I wanted to take what was publicly out there on social media and say, no, there's more to my country. Here's the goodness in my country. Here's the beauty in my country. And it doesn't get written about enough. That was, if I had to, in retrospect, examine intention, that was the intention.
Was there something that you really wanted to say that you thought hadn't been said?
No, I'm too early in my comedy career to think I'm saying things that haven't been said before. You know, I think, you know, I'm 15 years in, which is not a long time, as you know, with comedians. We get to our peak powers maybe 30 years in. So I just assume that every idea I have, somebody greater than me has done better than me before. That's the assumption.
Okay, so that's interesting to me. So let's talk about you as a comedian, because I'm fascinated by... Because you seem to be somebody who has an incredible drive as a comedian.
Yes.
A drive to... And what is that drive? Is it a drive as an artist? Is it a drive to be well-known, to be famous? Is it a drive to be the best comedian in the world? Like, what is the drive that is inside you?
Well, I know what it's not. It's not fame. Because if fame is your driving force, there's no reason to ever travel the world. India does fame better than anyone in the world. Bollywood fame or Indian movie industry fame is unlike anything you've ever seen before. And if you're able to sell that, or you're able to, like, I'm just not. You know, I remember the moment I knew I possibly wasn't cut out for Bollywood is I had, you know, every film has five songs, right? Because we love a spectacle and we love to celebrate. And going to the movies is, people forget that Bollywood movies are the best form of escapism. You know, somebody who's worked the entire week gets one outing, and that Sunday morning with the family, go and see an Indian movie. So if you show that guy Spotlight, he's going to kill himself. You know, you need to show him amazing things and celebrate. And it takes a certain amount of security and swag to sell that I just don't have. I remember I was standing on a beach and... I was in a chiffon yellow shirt and I hadn't eaten carbs in like 9 weeks and I hadn't drunk water in 48 hours, which is how you get the six pack, by the way. It's dehydration. It's not gym time. You just cut out water and salt. It's cheating. And
might be for you guys, but we're a country of Hemsworths. We all...
Yeah, sure. And so I'm standing in like white pants and white shoes in a chiffon shirt, and five people are pointing like air blowers at my shirt so it blows in the wind, and some lady's running towards me in slow motion, except it looks like slow motion when you play it back, but that chick is sprinting her ass off at you. So A, you're thinking, I feel dehydrated and I'm not sure I'm strong enough to carry her when she arrives. And I just don't have the swag for this. So maybe I'm better off traveling the world. And then I think there exists a vacancy for a global Indian perspective. You know, everywhere I go in the world, there's this wonderfully thought out local Indian perspective. Mm-hmm. You know, a Canadian Indian perspective, an Indian in America perspective, an Aussie Indian perspective. But there's nobody, you know... just who's from India. A Dave Chappelle can take me to Ohio. I've never been to Ohio, and I don't particularly care about Ohio. No offense to anybody who's from Ohio at the Sydney Opera House, but why can't I take you to Mumbai? Or why can't I take you to Delhi and have that be an equally engaging story? You know, for years, I'd watch comics abroad, and they'd do the Indian accent, sort of a punchline, and I'm like, why isn't that accent ever saying anything? You know, to me, that accent is a perspective. It's not a punchline. So I want to take that accent across the world and talk about your country for a change.
So I think that is what separates your work from, you know, people that I've seen do similar things, because there is something that is... I mean, because you have a very interesting story. Like, I mean, you spent some time in America at college. Yes. Like, you have an, you know, you spent some of your time growing up in Nigeria.
Yes.
I believe.
Yeah.
So, how long were you in Nigeria?
Well, it's a. I think my perspective is an outsider perspective, because my parents just were like, the minute I arrive at happiness, they're like, no, let's move him. So I was born in Dehradun in India, and to a reasonably privileged family. And just as I was getting comfortable, when I was one, they're like, no, let's take him to Africa and put him in public school in Africa, where he will get his ass whooped every week because he's the kid from India. And then I got my ass whooped every week. And when I was eight and I'd finally made friends, they were like, no, now let's send him to private school in India, where he will get his ass whooped every week because he's the kid from Africa. And then after that, just as soon as I was doing well in private school in India, they're like, no, let's in boarding school in India, let's send him to public school in India, where I got my ass whooped because I was the kid from boarding school. And then just as soon as I found a girlfriend in year one of college in India, they sent me to America to break my heart. And I went from New Delhi, which is this bustling sort of metropolis, to Galesburg, Illinois. The mecca of civilization as we know it, which is Cornfield College, Cornfield. And I learned to act there, and then I went back to India, where I went into Bollywood as the guy from drama school in America, and now I'm working in America as the guy from Bollywood. So it's just always been kind of an outsider.
So that outsider perspective is really fascinating to me. Yeah. What do you think that gives you as a comedian?
You take nothing for granted. And you have zero entitlement to anything.
Are you worried that your success will lead to entitlement? Like, I mean, often the more successful you become,
yeah,
you know, the greater your expectations become about, like, what you are entitled to because of the hard work that you've done.
Yeah.
Do you worry that success brings with it entitlement?
I don't define success as things that are given to you. Like, my definition of success... And I think most comedians will relate to this because we have overactive imaginations, right? So to me, success is the amount of time that passes between you waking up in the morning with an idea and somebody believing in that idea. Whatever that gestation period is, that's success. And the more successful you get, the smaller and smaller that gestation period becomes. Like tomorrow, if, I don't know, Leonardo DiCaprio woke up and he's like, I want to make a movie about... donkeys that do judo in Peru. Next week, a donkey will be learning judo and a Peruvian line producer will be, you know, scouting locations, etc., etc. And that's his gestation period. I've woken up a long time in my life with 10 ideas in my head every morning and nobody willing to listen to them. So to me, success means I have to ignore the bullshit. And I think you're allowed to lose yourself for about 3 or 4 years, which I definitely did, you know, where you have an entourage and you wear sunglasses in airports. You know? And nobody talks about the fact that you wear sunglasses in airports so that you can watch other people look at you without making eye contact. That's why celebrities do that shit. So you're allowed to do that for about 3-4 years in your life, until you finally figure out that shit's in your way, you know, and that it's preventing you from writing a good joke.
So the loose premise of this show is that I ask people whether they have a life philosophy of any kind. It can be in regard to life in general, but it can be in regard to love or,
yeah,
you know, your work or comedy. Do you have one?
It's more of a, I think, an insecurity, but I think it's a life philosophy as well. There's two. One is, I believe strongly in instant karma. And it's kind of a hybrid on you know, me being a Hindu as well. But I believe that if something bad happens in my life this week, I can think of something I did last week that was wrong. And that's how I connect events in my life. So if I lose a project, or if a show doesn't go well, or if, you know, something wrong happens, I'm like, maybe I was rude to that person last week, or maybe I told a lie last week. Now the flip side of that is you take on a lot of guilt, yeah. Right? And it's also reasonably self-indulgent, right? Yeah. Because you're like, oh, Donald Trump won the election because I was an asshole to somebody last week. Which, yeah. You know, it seems
a little self-involved.
Right? Right?
But I really should have tipped more. That's why COVID happened.
Yeah. But it's a good way of keeping yourself in check with humanity, right? So that's one.
And yeah, so do you actually believe in it, or do you believe in it as a way of operating in your life? Like, is it an actual belief that you have that the universe works in that way, that if you do something bad, then, you know, you won't get that thing that is good? Or is this just a way that you operate as a person where you say, the more positive things I put out into the universe, the more likely positive things are going to happen?
I think it's more in retrospect as like a coping mechanism. If something bad is happening, I won't be like, why is this happening, or poor me. I don't like feeling sorry for myself. So I will think about, is there anything wrong I did recently? And I'll be like, okay, just don't do that again. You know, so if nothing else, I come out from this experience a slightly better person. Mm. And then the other thing I do is I make the poster first. So the way that I got into stand-up is very random, but I was in a computer lab in my college late at night in Galesburg, Illinois, and there was a movie out called White Men Can't Jump. I don't know if you remember that movie, right? And so I'd just been a fan of Richard Pryor and Carlin and Eddie Murphy, and I designed a poster, and the poster said, Brown Men Can't Hump, which, firstly, you know, there's a billion of us, we clearly can, all right?
I mean, if anything, you should calm down a little. Yeah. I don't know what it's
And I printed 200 copies and put it up all over the college and booked the auditorium before I'd written my first joke. And it was 2 months out. So then I gave myself 2 months to write 60 minutes of material. And that's kind of worked out for me even till date. You know, with the Two Indias aftermath, there wasn't a person that was willing to work with me. You know, kind of everything went away overnight in that week.
It really, did it really? So, I know you've written a show about this and people will be able to see the show, but
yes.
Tell us a little bit about the reality of what that experience was.
Well, within 72 hours, every producer, director, brand, venue is just like, we love him, not right now.
So what's that feeling like? If what you told me earlier is true, that you really had not thought this through and you did not consider what the consequences of it were going to be, then it goes out and you immediately have this reaction. You as a person who had been invited to the Kennedy Center to speak, a person whose career was taking off all over the world, was already very well established in India, but like was growing in America, was growing in the UK. You were touring to all these countries in the world. Did you, in that moment, just talk us through how you were feeling?
There's no bravado in that moment. It is guilt and shame. That's all it is, you know, to be very honest with you. And
you're like, shit, I should have been better to that woman on the bus.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. but also, fuck, I burnt it all to the ground.
Yeah. And so did you really feel like that? Did you feel like I've sailed too close to the sun? I've taken this for granted.
For sure.
I've fucked it all up.
You know, I will never touch a microphone again. And I remember the call like it was yesterday. My management, who's been with me for 10 years, they're like, Veer, you just need to go underground. Nobody will work with you right now. Yeah. And I'm like, well, how do I earn a living? And they're like, well, you have a social media following, so we can get stuff through that. And I'm like, so I'm an influencer now? Fuck you, I'll jump off a building tomorrow. I have too much talent to be an influencer. But no, then you kind of go away. But then, so That happens.
So immediately it happens. Immediately it feels like, yeah, there is outrage in the community. Even from people who were genuinely supporters from you, there were people just going, this is just not what we want to see from the guy that we've come to love through Brown Men Can't Hump. No, but I mean, was there genuinely even people who had been invested in, you know, building your career to that point who thought you had gone too far?
No. I just cut it all out. Like, I'm just going to be honest. I lay down for a month. And I mean, like, I physically lay down for a month. Very hard to get out of bed. And then when I finally put my phone on, there were millions and millions of messages from across the world. And it wasn't hatred. You know, it was love. And you've suddenly represented this very real connection with people. And I just remember writing, it happened in November, writing my first joke in February, you know, and it was just one line. I was just like, they called me a terrorist on the news. I just remember thinking, this is so insulting to actual terrorists. Yeah. Like, can you imagine how terrorists feel? They're like, this guy? Like, you know? And then I wrote a show about it. But back to poster first. In February, I announced a world tour. And what that means is I literally cut a promo on my laptop and I put 29 countries on it. And I called it the Wanted Tour. And I'm not kidding. Not a venue booked. Not a brand willing to work with you. One joke written. I put the video out on YouTube. And, you know, 200,000 views, 300,000 views, and then you have to chase that poster, right? I'm not a boastful man, but I'm very proud of the fact that it's been a year. I've been to 25 of those 29 countries with my show this year, you know?
Yeah. Which ones haven't you been to?
I couldn't do Europe with the show, unfortunately. So I couldn't do, like, Paris, and I couldn't go back to Nigeria with it, but we've done everything else, pretty much everything else. We've done 179 shows this year, in the last 9 months.
Yeah, and you've taped the show.
I've taped the show. Yeah.
And so people are going to get to see the show now. The show that isn't about what, well, it tells, you know, some jokes about what happened, right?
Like, it does, but it's more about going home once you've been lost in the world. The show is called Landing, and it's about that flight home. After this experience. And I had a lovely Air India air hostess kind of sit me down, and she was like, just drink some gin. And I was like, I don't drink gin. And she's like, no, you're probably going to jail, so drink some gin. Come on. Let's have some gin.
Yeah, you better get used to this. This is what they make in the toilet, and it's all you can drink.
And it was a beautiful thing because I was like, I think I messed up. And I think maybe as somebody who was very proud to represent my country, I misstepped. But then she really represents my country. This 65-year-old lady, she goes to every country in the world. There is no better representative of my country than her. I'm an idiot. That's a representative of India. And if she finds some kindness or some empathy in what I've said and a connection, then I have to honor that connection. And so, in a sense, the show is what it means when an idiot carries his country across the world and what it means to honour that connection. Really.
So so as an outsider, which I am in this situation, like when I watch you perform this piece, it's hard for me to understand like how perhaps offensive it could be to people because I don't have that cultural context. All I get to see is just an incredible artist presenting a piece that certainly opened my eyes to some things, but to me, it's just an artist expressing something in an artistic way. Was there genuine fear that, you know, that the government in particular in India, you know, might find this a very problematic thing?
No, and they've been largely out of it. You know, it's been other people, you know, that, and I always say this, you know, people with power anywhere in the world, people with power are never the problem. It's people with 5 degrees of separation from power. Those guys are always a problem everywhere in the world. Much like, I think in a company, the intern is never an asshole And the CEO is never an asshole. But like the VP of sales, that guy's a fucking asshole. You know what I mean? Like, always.
Yeah.
Because he has to oppress the lower guy and impress the upper guy, right? So it's always that guy who's somewhere on the periphery of power who creates problems. But he's never the guy officially in power, you know?
So when you... When people are going to see this, I mean, obviously you've toured at a whole bunch of places. What tends to be the response from people in the room when they get to see you talk about this?
I don't know. You know, it's a weird thing right now. You know, these things can be a blessing and a curse as well, where suddenly your tickets sell out everywhere, right, in a few minutes. And the only thing that it has given me is... As an artist, your big endeavor is never just to succeed with the art form on that evening, right? Like, I think there's a moment of flow that happens between an audience member and an artist. Like, at some point, if you go and see a great concert or a great band or a great play, there's this moment where you sit down and, you know, it's a one-second thing where you go, fuck, this was worth it. You know, like, when an audience feels that, 99% of the time, the artist feels it at the exact same moment, you know, where we're both just like, oh, I'm so happy I did this. It was worth the babysitter. It was worth the drive. It was worth everything. When you represent a very real connection to people, you know, where it's no longer, hey, I like your stuff. You're funny. It's, you made me feel something. And that's why I came in the door. That moment of flow arrives a little bit sooner, and I can push your envelope a little bit more, and we can go someplace a little bit, maybe shakier, maybe cooler, maybe more vulnerable together. So it changes that moment of flow between an audience and an artist.
Okay, so this is what I love about your work, is that you clearly are looking for a connection between you and the people that you're talking to.
Oh, for sure.
But... You don't just want to pander to your audience to get that connection.
No.
What you want to do is use that connection to then be able to take you both into an area that might be less comfortable for both of you. So tell me about that. Tell me about that transition from everybody in the room is on my side and understands what I'm going to say, and now I'm going to use that connection to take us to somewhere that is a little bit more dangerous.
I think a lot of times comedians who lionize themselves preface it as danger. Do you know what I mean? Where they're like, oh, this is a dark joke about some dark shit. And everybody's like, ooh, right? And then it's about a tweet or some shit like that, right? Yeah. But, and I think we all know those comics, right? ooh, look at you. You read a tweet. But if you come from a place of, I don't know what the hell I'm talking about. And I'm scared of this too. And I haven't fully figured this out yet. That's cool to me. To be kind of emotionally naked on stage. You know, there was a... Like, I do this series called 10 on 10. And we've done stuff about religion or about, you know, freedom of speech.
So explain to people a little bit more about what 10 on 10 is.
So 10 on 10 is, I just decided I would write 10 pieces of comedy about the world.
And again, this is very much an example of you doing the poster before you write the show.
For sure.
You said what you were going to do and then set yourself the challenge of doing it.
For sure. And then we did it outdoors. So I hide in a forest and people come out in sunlight to hear these conversations. So the first five have been about freedom of speech, religion, privilege in the West, the second wave of COVID, and cancel culture. So, you know, fun topics. but it is a comedian trying to figure these things out. So when it comes to religion in comedy, you know, it was me going up there going, I'm going to make fun, not me going up there going, I'm going to make fun of every God. It's, wouldn't God have a sense of humor? I mean, he made you.
I mean, I didn't like the way you looked directly at me when you said that, but...
But, you know, but it's the exploration of, do I think God would be funny? You know, and if they were, how would different gods take comedy? Mm. So it's not coming from a place of arrogance. It's coming from a place of wonderment. You know, the new one that I'm writing, and I'll hopefully film it in 2 weeks, is about war. And I don't know about you guys, but I feel like, do you feel like a third world war is coming at some point? right? But the place of wonderment is, all these people say these things where they're like, it feels like it did before. But anyone who experienced the Second World War now was like fucking 5 years old during the Second World War. Like, to you, a Nazi could have been an action figure. You didn't know. So I just don't have anyone to talk to recognize wartime patterns at a global level. And that's scary.
So we live in a time when not only there might be a World War III, but at the moment Zelensky, of course, who's in charge of Ukraine, was formerly a comedian.
Yes, yeah.
How do you feel when it comes to the idea of like genuine leadership? Because obviously as a comedian, you're talking about a whole bunch of things that people are responding to in a way where they genuinely are looking at you now as somebody who, you know, is a philosopher on these topics. And I know that your approach is comedic, but you can't choose the topics that you've chosen for the 10 on 10, for example, without saying, I want to use my comedy to say something about the world. So how do you then differentiate how much of it is comedic and how much of it is people are going to genuinely look to me for some sort of insight and leadership around these topics?
I think if you're looking to me for any insight, there's more wrong with you than there is with me. We're both fucked, right? I've never aimed to be your direction or your point of view on something. I aim to be your coping mechanism with something hard. So if you're thinking about war, if you're worried about freedom of speech, let me say something stupid enough so that every time you're worried about it, you remember something stupid I said, and hopefully it's easier to cope with it, right? Maybe as you get older, I'm 43, maybe you don't get funnier, maybe you don't get better, but more of your conscience at least imprints onto the page. You access who you are a little bit better. And I don't think you should... Look, I think we all know parallels are always drawn between comedians and politicians, for instance, because we're both essentially public speakers. But politicians display leadership. And I think leadership has been reduced to public speaking. But I think leadership is much larger than public speaking. You know, that's just kind of how I feel about it.
Yeah. So you talk about the idea of God,
yes.
And gods, you know,
yes.
Other people's gods. But when you speak about God and being blessed by God, are you specifically, you know, referring to God? Like,
yeah, I am a Hindu and I'm a practicing Hindu. So I do celebrate every Hindu festival. I indulge in you know, ceremony with my family, etc. But I do believe in a universal higher power as well. I used to write a joke about it where I was like, I think like there's one God and she was a woman and she just went on dates with multiple prophets. You know, and like she said the same things to every single prophet, but because they were men, they understood different shit and wrote different shit down. And that became religions. So I do believe that there is a universal higher power, but I love the principles of Hinduism.
What is it about Hinduism in particular? I mean, culturally, something that you were obviously raised around, but like, what is it about it? You've seen and compared religions of the world, you know, and you could choose to follow anyone that you would like, you know. What is it about that religion that appeals to you?
Focus on work. Focus on acceptance, focus on family, and focus on the idea of karma. These are the four things I love about Hinduism. We cherish our families. We cherish that we have a duty towards humanity and to serve other people. We cherish, you know, the idea that we will repent or be rewarded, and we accept every other religion peacefully. So I love that about my religion.
Yeah. One of the pieces of yours that I loved, that I first saw, that I just thought was fantastic, because I'm not a religious person myself, but I very much like the idea that there are core tenets to every religion that are just good practical advice, you know. And you had an incredible like piece that I just thought was, you know, so many people have tried to tackle this topic, but basically, without me trying to murder your material, it was about the idea that there are four basic tenets that are in every religion.
Oh,
and then there's a
yes, and then one random thing they throw in there just to see if you're paying attention, right? So like every religion is like, don't lie, don't steal, don't kill, don't fuck, don't eat chicken on Tuesdays, right? Just to see if you're You know.
Yeah. It's the equivalent of, they always used to say that artists backstage on the rider would ask for blue M&Ms, not
just
because they wanted
the rider,
blue
yeah.
M&Ms, just to make sure that they read all the rider. Yeah. And it feels like that with religion. So then one of the big questions I always ask on this show is, what do you think happens when you die? Do you think about that? And what do you think happens?
I saw a movie that I loved. I don't know if you remember. It's called Defending Your Life. It was, I think, Albert Brooks and Meryl Streep. And the idea that there exists this limbo, and when you die, you have to go up and defend the life that you had. So did you spread enough love or did you not spread enough love? And if you spread enough love, you get to move on to whatever on is. And if you didn't spread enough love, you're sent back down to spread some more love. You know, so I like that idea where at some point, I like the notion of reaching to a place where there will be a conversation with somebody about the life that you had. And you will get to introspect about the life that you had. And at that moment, you will truly understand what was important in life, and that was love. Like, I like that idea.
So what is important to you then? If you were to have that conversation now, if this was that conversation, mm-hmm. if I was sitting you down now to say, like, justify your life to me, like, you know, like, what do you, you know, what do you value?
I live a strange life, you know, where God gives, God takes, you know. So I definitely have had to sacrifice normalcy, or I don't know where the light switches are in my house. You know, I've never planted something and watched it grow. But I've seen the world 5 times. You know, who gets to say that? It's a gigantic privilege to say, and not notionally, I've literally seen the world and been across it 5 times. And the soundtrack to that experience has been millions of people laughing. And the indulgent way to look at that is to think about how somebody made people laugh. But if you just reverse it for a second and think about what it does to your system to hear millions of people laughing for you or at you, it's the healthiest fucking thing in the world, you know? So that sound, that soundtrack to my life and that connection, I think, is the most important thing there is.
You talk about love. You're married.
I am married, yes.
Tell me about love when it comes to love of a partner and what that means to you.
It's not somebody you can talk to. It's somebody who you can spend long silences with and feel things in those silences. My wife is the only dose of reality I have in my life, and so I value her tremendously. We met in a reality check. I'm in a band, and my band was...
Like a comedy band,
like,
right?
A comedy band, but like, yeah, a legit rock band, right?
Yeah. Sorry, I didn't mean to diminish you. I just mean that,
yeah, you know,
it's a rock band, but like a Tenacious D
like
style.
Like a Tenacious D type of, yes, thing. And we were late for sound check, and because we were getting high in the green room or whatever. And and then my wife used to run like India's Rolling Stone magazine. It was called Rock Street Journal. So she's done like Megadeth concerts and like Herbie Hancock concerts, and this beautiful woman kind of busts in. She's like, "You're late. Get your fucking ass on sound check. There are bigger bands than you waiting for that stage." And I was like, "I will hit on you immediately."
I'm sure it was the first time anyone had ever thought that.
And so no, she's really just kind of, to me, home isn't a place, it's her. And she's really the only regular dose of reality and grounding in my life.
Do you have a philosophy when it comes to love? Like, is there a guiding principle that you think of? Or maybe not even love, maybe in like maintaining a relationship with somebody. Is there some philosophy that you have towards a relationship?
I think that closeness with somebody sometimes leads you towards unkindness. Mm. As if unkindness is the entitlement that comes with closeness, right? Oh, we hurt the ones we love, blah, blah, blah. I think closeness should drive you towards kindness, even if it feels unnatural in those moments. Like, you have to be kind to the closest person in your life. Like, to me, that's love, is finding kindness with someone, you know?
When are you at your worst? What does that look like? Because, like, I speak to you and, I this was the first time that we've met tonight, but I felt like I already knew you from listening to you on podcasts, from consuming your work. I can see the love that is behind it. I can see the passion that's behind it. I can see the incredible intellect that is behind what you do. And despite the fact that, you know, I still think that you diminish a little bit about, you know, I get it. You're a comedian. Yeah. It's nice to be self-deprecating, but I think that you are an incredibly powerful intellectual person. But what does it look like when it's not working? What's Veer when things aren't working and you look in the mirror and you say, I'm not at my best right now. What does that look like?
It's usually food involved, for sure. I stress eat and I stress smoke. I love cigarettes, but only when I'm stressed out is my thing. So I'm usually smoking and eating and... I'm not patient with letting things take their course. Mm-hmm. I have to fix it. Or I have to think of the next thing that will fix it. So to me, it's that. It's you know, for instance, when the controversy happened, and it's not my first controversy. I've been in the industry for a while. I've been called out for jokes before. Sometimes... articles are written about you that is false. So, you know, these things happen in an entertainment career. And what everybody tells you is just sit back and it will go away. A news cycle lasts 4 days. It will go away. I am unable to shut the fuck up for 4 days. Do you know what I mean? Like, I just cannot. I'm like, what the fuck do you mean? Yeah. It will go away. Yeah. Let's make it go away in half an hour. And they're like, you cannot. You just have to sit back and it will go away. I'm entirely unable to do that till date.
You talk about the idea of, like, you know, there's jokes you've been called out for. You've talked about cancel culture in one of your 10 for 10s. Talk to me about the idea of, I mean, I'll offer something of my own first, which is, so I've been doing this for 27 years now. Yes. So, as you know, there's things that I might have said 20 years ago that I wouldn't say today if I was sitting down to write a show. Is there parts of your... How do you deal with that evolution as being a comedian? Maybe there being things that you've said previously that you wouldn't say today, or maybe there isn't. Maybe you see that as being a natural evolution of what it is to be a comedian. Just talk to me a little bit about, you know, the idea of, what is appropriate to say and how you decide what is appropriate to say and how you deal with things that you've said previously that maybe you wouldn't say again now.
I don't think any artist, if you come from a place of ego as a comic, then you think you're telling people how it is. And I think we all know that comic gets old after a while. But if you come from a place of, I'm figuring this shit out just like you are, you buy yourself a little time to figure it out, number one. And two, happy to apologize at all times. Zero ego. Take your feedback, mouth shut, head down. Never defend a joke. If you've hurt somebody's feelings, whether that was your intention or not, always acknowledge their feelings. You know, the thing is, the audience was never such an active part of the conversation before. It used to be like, here's my jokes, thank you so much, good night, on to the next city. Mm-hmm. But now their voice is larger than your voice, and you have to honor that voice in the conversation. If it ever becomes abusive, or whatever, if it ever breaks the law, or if it ever becomes combative, or like an attack, you don't have to. But I think if you come from a place of, I acknowledge your feelings, you'll buy yourself freedom to be fallible, which is really what every artist deserves. I deserve the freedom to be fallible. I deserve to go on stage with 5 new minutes that aren't very good yet, you know, and aren't very well thought out yet. Maybe only in a comedy club. Maybe not, you know, at the Enmore Theatre or whatever. But you weren't that great at chartered accountancy your first year in it, or at engineering your first year in it. You had some fuck-ups. They weren't public. And you may never be called out for them. I will. But the level of fuck-up is the same. You know, we're both entitled to that fuck up.
And so then how do you find a space to push yourself to experiment, because obviously the more eyes that are on you,
yes,
the more attention that's being paid to you, it's very hard for you to then, you know, just try something out, you know, push an idea, like try something new. Where do you find that space?
I think you have to set the right context and then just go ahead and do it. Don't do it without setting context, right? Like anybody like who comes out and he's like, so Jewish people, no, right? That's not the way.
I don't know, man. I was listening to Kanye. Yeah, he makes exactly, a lot of good points. So. Right?
But if you come from a place of everybody seems to be talking about Jewish people, I've never met a Jewish person, here's things I think about and here are my jokes. That's a little bit more honest. Mm. You know, maybe you're putting yourself out there a little bit. And then just go ahead and do it. And what people forget about comics is there's nothing that you can say to me that is worse than silence from an audience. That's the worst feeling in the world, when we know a joke hasn't worked. And we always know when the laughter is easy. We always know when the laughter is just like, oh, you know, there's when it's clapter, or when it's like, ooh, 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 but it's not a real laugh. It's just like, he said something people don't say. And it might not necessarily be funny. Comedians, we know that.
Okay, so that's very interesting to me, the way that you think about that. Because again, with the level of fame that you've had in some places, you could very much just, that could be your career. You know, you could, you know, you could literally just tour, people could like reinforce how great they are, you could do the same thing over and over, yeah, and people could just say, we love this, like don't change, don't push yourself, we're happy with you just exactly how you are now. But that is not what you are. You go to places where people don't know where you are, you film a special where you film it in a stadium in front of 11,000 people and then go and film like it in a club in New York in front of like a couple of hundred of people.
It was 110 Americans, hostages really, in a basement. And it was the week after Donald Trump had won the election. Yeah. So it was just the saddest Americans in the world. And of all the people who could be sad, there's nothing sadder than a sad American. Yeah. You know what I mean? Because they're just like, because they're so USA, you know, and then to just see them like, it's hilarious.
But why that? Like, I mean, that's what, I mean, I think I probably know what the answer is, but I want to hear what your answer is. That why a person who's like playing to 11,000 people in a stadium, why is there also the compulsion to be playing to 100 sad Americans?
I want to get really good at this. Mm. Like, that's the only way to do it, is you have to play like tennis with people who are way better than you are to get good at tennis, or play tennis with people who you've never played with before to get good at tennis. Like the Comedy Cellar, for instance, in New York, is a lovely club. It's a legendary club, right? And on any given night, you'll see someone from a Chris Rock to a Chappelle to a Kevin Hart, or just loads of comics who are 20, 30-year comics in New York whose names you do not know, who are fucking assassins, and who are impossible to follow. And I like going to the Comedy Cellar and spending 3 months a year there and just trying to follow these people and shitting my pants, watching somebody amazing who you may not know yet, and touch wood, will soon, and having to follow that person. Like, I tell this story often, but like I was there, and I think Chris Rock was testing his new hour. And usually when a legendary comic comes in, they'll bump the lineup or they'll move the lineup. And so some of you will move on to your next spot. And I was just like taking school, right? Taking class, because you're watching a master do his work. And imagine you came in one night and, you know, you spent $12 to see six guys. And then you saw Chris Rock for like an hour and a half do his new special. What an evening that is for you. And I think they hadn't dropped the check yet. And the lady who manages it, her name is Liz, she's like, Veer, do you want to go up and do 5 minutes after Chris Rock? while they drop the checks, which is when people are at their unhappiest.
Yeah, but, I mean, it's not an Australian tradition. So to explain, like at a comedy club over there, people during the night are ordering their drinks and whatever, and then there's the spot right towards the end where they literally put the checks on everybody's table, and it is the worst part of the entire night because everyone is like arguing over who had the corn chips. Did you have corn chips? Like, did you have two margaritas or did I have? And you're trying to do comedy at that time. So Chris Rock has been on, and so they're also dropping
Chris the
check.
After Chris Rock for free.
Yeah.
Now corn chips, and I was like, fuck yes, I would like to go on, you know, and again, context is everything. So I went up and I'm like, I'm fucking terrified right now because I'm following Chris Rock, but what do I have to lose at this point? And suddenly they're with you because we're all thinking the same thing, right? Full disclosure is a very powerful thing, right?
Yeah, everyone in the room is like, who is this poor fucker?
Exactly, right? And so if you go up there and you're like, yo, it's the end of the show, I'm following Chris Rock, and I have an Indian accent. Yeah. Everybody's just like, aw, right? And so they're on your side.
Yeah.
And I was able to put my foot in their ass for 5 minutes, you know, and it went well. And then she made me do it 7 nights in a row, you know. But I will not get to experience that just playing big rooms everywhere. So it is important to put yourself in the comedy cellar for 3 months a year and to get your ass handed to you. And I think it will make you a better artist.
Do you think, and this is going to be an incredibly difficult thing for you to answer, and I'm absolutely fine if you need to joke this away and can't answer this. But I think when you have the talent that you have and the perspective you have and the attitude to comedy that you have just talked about then, about the idea of wanting to be able to follow Chris Rock and not just be able to follow Chris Rock like by going on stage, but being able to go out there and represent yourself well. Do you want to finish your comedy career with people talking about you the way that people talk about Chris Rock? That, like, I had to go into the comedy cellar and Veer Das was on and, like, you know, the entire crowd, like, I can't believe that I had to follow him. Is that part of what you hope and dream of with your comedy career?
The best that I can hope for is whether they saw 5 minutes of me or 5 hours of me, they felt like they knew me. To me, that's gold. You know, when you watch a musician or an actor or an artist and you're like, I know this person. You know, they put something out there. You know, they made me laugh. Sure, anybody can make you laugh. They made me dance. Sure, anybody can make you dance. Did I know them? And not because I had done research on them. Do you know what I mean? Not because I was familiar with them. But I just felt like I knew them. If I can achieve that, that's the top of the mountain for me.
Can you tell me about a time when you've been that person in the audience? Is there something that comes to mind when, it doesn't even have to be comedy, it can be anything that you were watching, that when you've experienced that, when you've been in the audience for something and said, I know this person who's on stage, is there one that comes to mind?
There's many, you know, Richard Pryor, you know, nobody was able to blatantly just be vulnerable and naked on stage, I think, like Richard Pryor, and to casually bring up pain in the most throwaway manner without ever indulging in it. You know, sometimes when we experience pain as live performers, it's so valuable to us that when we talk about it on stage, the lights change, and you know, and we milk that shit, and no judgment if you do, but
No, I get that. I've got a new show in 2 months and I've got fuck all to talk about, and I really hope the government wants to fucking put me in prison. I could really do with that. But no,
I can make some calls. Yeah.
No, I'm white. I can't get arrested.
It's true. Yeah. True. Yeah.
So what is it about that connection though when you watch someone like Pryor? Like when you talk about that idea of, you know, not milking the pain, but identifying the pain, being able to express the pain. What is it, do you think? What differentiates those two things?
Maybe because, perhaps because he's beyond it, or because he's, maybe not dealt with it, but he's processed it for comedy, So in that sense, he... like, that's something I was thinking about on this show, right? There, mm-hmm. there was a moment on this show where I talk about being at the Emmys, and I was nominated for one, and I was at this hotel called the Beekman in New York. And I remember thinking I've burnt my career to the ground. And the hotel is hollow. And I remember standing in this fancy Emmys outfit and just thinking I should jump because this is perfect. They can send me off in the outfit, right? Is the... And when you're writing a joke like that, the temptation is to go, I should jump, dramatic pause, it's all over. Or then go to something big, right? But if you think about what a Pryor does with that, or somebody else does with that, they go from this largely massive thing and like trivialize it. And I think that's a much more powerful thing. So I was like, you know, I was like, I should jump, but I don't think my wife will get her deposit back from the hotel. And if I land in the lobby in New York, I'll scare the shit out of three countries minimum. And there'll be a cleaning fee. And, you know, just like going to like little things like that. I think that's a better way to go than to talk about, you know, to take powerful things to dramatic things. For instance, that's what I like that he did.
I honestly could talk to you for hours, but unfortunately we're running out of time. I want to ask you about what's next. Because, I mean, you are a person who, you know, doesn't believe that you're at the peak of what you're doing.
No.
You believe that there is more to explore.
I'm not even at base camp yet.
I mean, I can't wait to see, if you're not at base camp yet, I can't wait to see what the rest of this climb is like. But what does it look like to you? Or what do you hope that it looks like to you?
I don't know. I'm still working on like next year's poster. You know what I mean? So I haven't thought that far in advance, but I just want to get better. That's all I want to do. I want to get really good at this.
If you could take one thing from, like, let's take Pryor out of it now, just because mm-hmm. we've already spoken about him.
Yeah.
You have the ability to take one skill from another comedian.
Yeah.
Anyone in the world, but there's just something they do that you would love to be able to do. What would it be?
I'll give you three, actually, because okay. I've thought about it a lot.
Good. Well, good, because we've got like 2 minutes. This will be a perfect ending.
Chappelle's vocal modulation, mm-hmm. Eddie Izzard's ability to make you believe like it was all made up on the spot, mm-hmm. even though it's very clearly written. It's a level of skill. And George Carlin's ability not to give a fuck. Those three things, I think, make the perfect comic.
Well, mate, it has been an absolute pleasure to have this conversation with you. I look forward to what's next. And, you know, I hope, you know, your God continues to be good to you. Thank you so much for being part of this. Can we please give it up for the fabulous Veer Das? Thank you so much for coming out. We'll see you next time. G'day, it's Will.
And this is Charlie, and our AFL adjacent podcast, Two Guys, One Cup, is back.
Yep, check it out now on the Listener app. In the meantime, here's a promo.
When it comes to footy podcasts, you can listen to the experts.
I feel their power's being undermined by the AFL system itself.
The analysts.
Tackles 25 to 16, 26 to 16. So don't they win in the ball?
Then there's Two Guys, One Cup. An AFL podcast with Will Anderson and Charlie Clawson.
Oh, Dougie.
Max Gawn's nickname is Dougie.
It's Dougie.
Do you reckon you could extrapolate from Gawn to Dougie? Max, Dougie, Gawn, gone, leave, leaves, trees in the ground, dig, dug, Dougie.
Will and Charlie may not always get it right.
I feel there's a lot of pessimism from Melbourne fans at the moment.
Yeah, I don't think they're a top eight side.
Melbourne are the premiers for 2021!
But they're never short of big ideas.
I believe the Candyman has retired the title of the Candyman, which means there is a big Candyman-shaped hole on the Gold Coast that could be filled by Ben King.
Two Guys, One Cup, a weekly AFL podcast with Will Anderson and Charlie Clawson.
We are Two Guys, One Cup.
Hear new episodes now on the Listener app.